This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Unloved, A Love Story by Katie Regnery, narrated by Maxine Mitchell and Joe Arden. Prologue. Bryn. My car wouldn't start. That's how it all began, with something as ordinary as a dead battery. Turning the key again and again, I was rewarded with silence and finally texted Jem that I wouldn't make it to the concert. I told him I was sorry. I told him to have a great time. I told him not to wake me when he got home. He didn't, because he never came home. A million times I've returned to that night, to the simple, nothing decisions that started a chain of events in my life leading to today. I think of Jem checking his phone, wondering why I was late. I picture him getting my text and grimacing in disappointment. I see him in my mind, considering whether or not to leave the club and come home to me. Or to stay. He decided to stay. 20 minutes later, he was dead. The shooter left a note saying that he didn't love or hate the music of Steeple 10. What he hated was the idea of all those people in a club for the same reason, having something in common that they all enjoyed. He didn't enjoy anything with anyone and was jealous of their communal happiness, their shared appreciation for noise pop. So he opened fire on 300 people packed into the crowded club, killing 31. Among them, my fiancé, Jem. Sometimes in my dreams, I'm back in my car on that rainy night, and the engine turns over. I drive to the club. I park outside. I see Derek Frost Willems get out of his 2011 Toyota Corolla, his black trench coat too heavy and too hot for an unseasonably humid August night in San Francisco. In some versions of my dream, I imagine myself intercepting him, talking to him, befriending him, and inadvertently letting him know that he's not alone. In others, I race into the club, looking frantically over the hot pink and indigo blue lights to find Jem's blonde spiked hair in the crowd. I imagine running to my love and telling him to lie down on the floor with me, since those who quickly dropped to the floor mostly survived. I imagine us huddled together on the filthy, beer-slick floor as bullets rain around us and terrified concertgoers slowly realize what's happening, darting chaotically in search of cover, slipping in pools of blood, trying desperately to dodge Willems's relentless rounds of open fire. But mostly, in 9 out of 10 dreams, I am too late. I see myself sprint. In slow motion, from my car to the club, swinging open the door just in time to see Willems turn the gun on himself, pull the trigger, and fall backward. I stand there, frozen, a lone, paralyzed figure, unable to help anyone, way too late to save Jem, who probably died instantly from a clean shot to his heart. To his strong, beautiful, bursting with love for me, heart. When I wake up, my pillow is drenched with tears, and I reach for Jem, hoping that the dream I've had is somehow just a horrible nightmare, not the truth, not an actual, outlandish, and still incomprehensible part of my life. But Jem's side of the bed is always empty now, as it's been for almost 2 years. The rest of the world moved on from the Steeple 10 shooting. Ever more numb to the news of similar events, out of sympathy for nameless strangers who meet the same tragic end. But I can't seem to move on. I had someone in the crowd that night who had a name, who was dearly loved. Those of us who survived are the walking wounded, or the walking dead. And some of us, even if we never set foot in the club that night, are still somehow there, facing the spray of Willems's fury with our lost loved ones, and uselessly wishing that everything could have turned out differently. Chapter 1. Bryn. Present day. Bryn, any chance you'll be able to complete the website by today? Was hoping to go live this weekend. Please advise. Stu. I stare at the email over the rim of my coffee cup, rolling my eyes. When I quoted Stu of Stu's Pools a price of $1,200 to build his website, I was clear that it would take up to 3 weeks to complete. It's been 10 days, and he's already bothering me to finish? I hate people, I tell Milo, my 4-year-old Siamese cat. Purring, he paces back and forth on my desk, between my forearms and the warm keyboard, before falling dramatically atop it. The screen quickly starts to fill with line after line of question marks. I can't work if you stay there, I say, taking another sip of coffee. Meow, he answers, licking his paw. Oh well, too bad for you. Milo has always been chatty. It was the reason that Jem chose him for me from all of the other kittens in the pet store that day.
Now you'll have someone to keep you company while you work, he said,
handing the cashier his credit card. I don't need anyone to keep me company, I pointed out. I like working alone. Besides, litter boxes aren't my gig.
I'll keep it clean, Jem promised.
I don't want the responsibility of a cat, I insisted, whining a little.
Just let him be your friend. I'll care for him, he said,
his New England accent strong on the word care, which sounded more like kea. In the end, that's what had swayed me, the way his sweet lips said care. It made my toes curl. I'd always had a thing for accents, and as a born and bred San Franciscan, I'd fallen for his at the first hello. Jeremiah Benton was from Bangor, Maine, a place so far from the Bay Area, it may have well been a different country altogether. What are you drinking? I asked him the first time I ever saw him. I was working behind the bar, blown away by the aqua blue of his eyes when he looked up at me, and determined to be nonchalant about how insanely, ruggedly hot he was.
Whatever you have on tap there.
Thea. Thea? I repeated, raising an eyebrow, my lips quirking up.
Did you lose an ah?
He asked, grinning at me through a scruffy beard. I think you did, I teased, pulling him a pint of Go West IPA. He chucked down half the beer and swiped at his beard before speaking again, those aqua eyes darkening just a touch as they captured mine.
Sweet girl, I'll wager I'm gonna lose more than just an awe to you by the time this is over.
Just like that, I was a goner. He told me he'd just spent a month hiking in the Sierra National Forest on assignment for Backpacker Magazine. I told him I'd never been on a hike in my entire life. He called me a city slicker and asked me when I was free to take one. I had never dated a customer before that day, despite many offers, but I told him I was free the following Saturday. He lost an R. I lost my heart. Meow? Asks Milo, pausing in his bath, his blue eyes demanding I return to the present day, which, unfortunately, includes building a website for Stu's Pools. I push Milo gently off the keyboard and delete 4 pages of question marks, toggling back to my email account. No, Stu, I'm sorry, but if you'll recall, our contract gives me 3 weeks to build the site. It will be ready on June 26, as promised. My fingers fly over the keys, my eyes always slower than the words I'm typing. When they finally land on the date, my fingers freeze and my breath catches. June 26th. June 26th. Jem's birthday. Jem's 30th birthday. The sudden lump in my throat is so big and so painful it almost feels like choking, so I reach up and massage it, pushing my rolling chair away from the desk, away from the date, away, away, away. Would have been. I say aloud, the words more bitter than my coffee. Would have been. Would have been. Would have been Jen's 30th birthday. I force myself to acknowledge. My therapist, Anna, told me it was like this when you lost a loved one in a violent or unexpected death. For years, or sometimes in extreme cases for the rest of your life, you might still keep track of the important days and milestones. It was because you never got to say goodbye or prepare yourself to say goodbye. Even if you are someday able to make peace with their passing, part of you may not be convinced that the loved one is actually gone. Some secret, hidden, yearning part of you might stubbornly hold on to the unconscious, irrational belief that they aren't actually gone at all. Just missing. Just away. And when your brain forces you to realize that they are, in fact, dead, for a moment, for that moment, you will lose them all over again. It doesn't happen to me as often now as it did in the first year, but it still happens occasionally, and it knocks me on my ass every time. Lean into it, advised Anna. Take a few minutes to remember Jem, what he meant to you, how much you loved him, and then take the time to say goodbye again. Ignoring it won't make it go away, Bren. Ignoring it will only keep you from healing. Leaning into it may help your mind eventually accept that he's really gone. With burning eyes, I stand up from the desk chair and leave my office, listening to my slippers scuffle against the hardwood floor of the hallway as I walk past the bathroom and hall closet. Entering the bedroom I shared with Jem, I head for the walk-in closet and step inside, reaching for the shoebox on the top shelf. Anna was also the person who helped me come to terms with donating Jem's clothes to Goodwill and sending his books and albums back to Maine for his parents to keep. I'd sent his beloved backpacking equipment, maps, and guidebooks to his twin sister, Hope, who was also a hiker. I'd kept for myself only what could fit in a small box. A matchbook from the bar where we'd met. Letters and postcards we'd written to each other during the 2 years we were together. Pictures from the various hikes we'd taken, mostly in Yosemite. My engagement ring, which I'd stopped wearing on the first anniversary of his death. And his cell phone. His cell phone. It lay, as it had for almost 2 years, in a Ziploc evidence bag, uncharged on the bottom of the box, his dried blood still caked in the crevice between the screen and the plastic body. It had been found several inches from his hand, under the hip of a Stanford undergrad who'd been at the concert with her sister. Milo wanders into the bedroom, his face inquisitive and vaguely accusatory as I sit down on the bed and open the box. Anna said to, I tell him, wiping a tear from my cheek. Meow, he answers, winding around my legs before lying down in a patch of sunlight on the carpet and giving me permission to grieve. My eyes settle first on the matchbook, a shiny fire engine red with downtime emblazoned across the top in silver. Pushing it aside, I find a picture of Jem and me, a selfie taken at the Vernal Fall footbridge in Yosemite. Wincing, I lift the pile of pictures and letters gingerly from the box and set them gently on my bed. Generally, I go through the photos at this point, crying as I remember good times, then tearfully replacing them and whispering, "Goodbye, Jem," as I recover the box and put it back in my closet. But today, for whatever reason, I turn away from the photos and look back in the box at the two items remaining. My ring and his phone. Impulsively, I reach for the phone and pull it from the box. Unsealing the evidence bag for the first time since it was given to me a year ago, I do something that makes my heart race so rapidly my head feels light. I lean over my bed and plug Jem's phone into the charger on my bedside table. After 2 years, it springs to life within seconds, the outline of a battery taking shape on the black screen. And though the speed and ease with which I am able to bring it back from the dead strikes me as almost obscene, my tears have receded, and I bite my lower lip as a rare feeling of anticipation washes over me. I have no idea what I'm hoping to find on Jem's phone, but it's been so long since it felt like something mattered to me, I lean into the feeling of excitement just a little. 2 years ago, before the Steeple 10 shooting, I had lived a full and rich life. Engaged to Jem and planning our wedding, I got together with my parents in Scottsdale regularly and went out with friends all the time. Soon after meeting Jem, I finished my course of study in website design and started picking up jobs right away. It wasn't long before I quit working at Downtime and spent most days working from home. I liked being on my own. Even though I was alone, I never felt lonely or isolated. 2 years later, however, that same job had become an easy way for me to separate myself from the world. I rarely leave my house, have my groceries delivered, and exercise on a treadmill in my bedroom. My trips to Scottsdale are infrequent, despite my mother's worried invitations to visit more often. Long ago, the friends that predated Jem grew tired of my ignoring texts and voicemails. They eventually stopped reaching out, finally telling me that when I was ready to hang out again, I should let them know. I am a hermit, except for my twice-monthly visits to Anna, and while part of me knows it isn't healthy, more of me doesn't care. Beep. I look over to see Jem's iPhone light up, an old picture of us filling the small screen and a polite demand for his passcode. With trembling fingers, I key in 062-687 and the screen changes immediately, his apps lining up in five neat rows. Calendar, clock, weather, messages. Voice memos, contacts, Safari, mail. Maps, settings, notes, camera, photos, TV, iBooks, Kindle, App Store, iTunes Store, music, Shazam. Though I've had the phone in my possession for almost a year, only now do I realize there is a smudge on the top corner of the screen, so faint it's only visible because of the lit-up screen now shining through it. Brownish red and slightly smeared, it's all that remains of a bloody fingerprint, and my breath catches as I stare at it. Slowly. So slowly, I run my finger over it, wondering when and how it got there, blinking at the screen in surprise as my unintentional keystroke opens Jem's final text message. The top of the screen reads Bryn, which means he was writing to me. An unsent message reads simply, Katad. Gasping, with the sudden, overwhelming realization that Jem had spent his last moment on Earth trying to write me a message, the screen blurs as my eyes fill with more burning, useless, punishing tears. To anyone else, Katad might look like gibberish, but I've seen the full word too many times not to recognize it. Katahdin. Mount Katahdin. The highest peak in Maine. The place where Jem said his soul had lived until he'd given it to me. Pressing his phone to my heart, I curl into a ball on my bed and weep.
What do you mean you're going to Maine? Bryn, if you need to get away, please come to Scottsdale. You can stay as long as you like.
Mom, please.
This doesn't make any sense, sweetheart, she says, her voice wavering between concerned and impatient.
I picture her at my parents' lavish mansion, sitting on a lounger beside the pool in a floppy hat, her youthful face marked with consternation.
We know how much you loved Jem, but it's been 2 years.
Stop, I demand softly. Of all the things people say to you after you lose someone you loved, being told that you should get over it is not only unhelpful, it's hurtful and infuriating. She sighs, but her voice remains gentle.
Bryn, sweetheart, please, come to Scottsdale for a week.
How can I help her understand what finding Jem's final message means to me? After these painful, wrenching 24 months of grieving him, in the past 2 days, I've felt something new galvanizing within me. A plan, a purpose, a reason to get up and actually leave my apartment. In a way I never saw coming, Jem is showing me from the grave how to say goodbye. He's giving me a chance to bury him and move on. But I have to battle my comfortable inertia and start moving to make it happen. Mom, he was writing to me. His last thoughts were of me and Katahdin. I know that because he was texting me. He was trying to type the name of the mountain in the last seconds of his life. Don't you see? I have to go. I have to go there for him. A few hiking trips with Jem several years ago doesn't prepare you to walk up a mountain clear across the country, she cries, all pretense of calm disappearing as her voice pitches to a level of near panic. There are bears, Bryn. It's the woods. I doubt you'll have a cell signal. It's so far away. If something happened to you, Daddy and I couldn't get there for days. I am your mother, and I love you, and I am begging you to rethink this plan. It's already done, Mom, I say. Jem's sister is picking me up at the airport on Sunday evening. I'm staying with her. She knows the mountain like the back of her hand. I hadn't spoken to Hope in over a year when I called her last night, and I worried about opening up deep wounds when I dialed her number. But she was as warm as she'd been the 2 times she'd visited me and Jem in San Francisco.
Bryn, how are you?
I'm okay, Hope. How are you?
I'm okay, too. Good days and bad, she admitted. You?
Same. I paused, breathing through my deep desire to weep. I miss him.
Me too. Every day.
I cleared my throat. I found something in Jem's things.
What? What do you mean?
I sent almost everything to you and your parents after it happened, but one thing I kept was his cell phone. By the time the police returned it, almost a year had passed. I put it in a box and kept it. I don't know why I never turned it on, but 2 nights ago I did.
My God, she said. What did you find?
Not much, but I think he was trying to message me as he died. I bit my lip, willing my voice to stay even. There was a fragment of a message. K-A-T-A-H-D.
Katahdin,
she cried. Exactly, I said. That feeling, that get up and start moving feeling, making my stomach flutter.
He was writing to you.
Yes.
You think he wanted you to go there?
I do.
Just to see it?
I don't know for sure, I said. I just know I need to go.
Oh, so you're coming east?
Her voice, which had been pretty warm until then, had cooled a touch, and I wondered for a split second if I was welcome. Though Jem's parents had hosted a small memorial service for their son, I hadn't flown out to Maine to attend. At the time, I'd been staying with my parents in Scottsdale, taking significant doses of Valium just to get through the day. But in the 2 years since the service, not attending had been one of my fiercest regrets, and I've always wondered if I inadvertently offended his parents and sister by not being there.
Mm-hmm.
On Sunday. Hope was silent for a moment before saying,
You're welcome to stay here. Do you need a ride from the airport?
My shoulders relaxed. That would be really great. I get in at 6:20 in the evening.
Writing it down so I don't forget.
Hope paused, but her voice grew cautious when she spoke again.
No offense, Bryn, but Katahdin isn't for beginners.
Which is why I bit my bottom lip, then plunged ahead. I'm hoping you'll go with me.
I wish I could, she said, but I leave for Boston on Monday morning.
I'll be gone for a week teaching at BU. How long are you staying?
Only 3 days, I said, wondering if I should have booked an open return, but didn't want to lose clients like Stu's Pools, who'd be expecting their finished work soon after I returned from Maine.
You know what, said Hope. You'll be fine. I'll map it out for you. Saddle Trail to Baxter Peak, sign in at the ranger station first. Take your time. There'll be tons of AT hikers.
AT?
Appalachian Trail. I mean, if you need help, someone will be around to give you a hand. I'll make sure you're outfitted, too, okay?
I'll lend you some of my stuff and get whatever else I think you'll need so you're all set. I'd really wished for Hope's company, but even alone, I knew there was no turning back. I needed to do this. For Jem. And for me. Sighing, I pushed my conversation with Hope from my mind and segue back to the conversation with my mother in which I'd just implied that Hope would be hiking with me.
Stop worrying, Mom. This is a good thing. I promise, it's going to be okay.
I don't like it, Bryn. You were medicated for months. Your father and I...
Mom, I need your support right now. For the first time since Jem died, I feel... I don't know, kind of excited about something. I feel like I have some direction, a purpose. I promise I'll be careful, but I have to do this. I need to.
My mother's silent for a while before asking,
"Do you need spending money?"
"I'm 30 years old, and you still treat me like I'm 11, I say, smiling down at Milo, who's weaving in and out of my legs.
"I love you," she says. "You'll always be 11 to me."
"I love you too." We talk about my dad's latest golf tournament win, and she updates me on my cousin Belle's new boyfriend. We end our conversation laughing, which hasn't happened in a long, long time. And as I place the handset back in the cradle and head to my room to start packing, I feel grateful. I feel ready.
Chapter 2. Cassidy. 6 years old. I happened upon my father in an old shed, back behind our house, dismembering a raccoon. Lying spread-eagled on its back, it was affixed by its paws with nails to a wooden table taller than I was. Rivulets of blood ran from all four paws and dripped softly onto the concrete slab floor below. After looking on with curiosity from just inside the shed's open door, I didn't make a peep as I approached the workbench, watching my father stare down in fascination at the dead animal, holding up what I have retrospectively identified as a bloody scalpel. It was only when I was mere inches away from the animal's face that I made eye contact with it and realized that it wasn't, in fact, dead. Its eyes, glazed over in agony, stared back at me and blinked. I gasped loud enough to distract my father, who turned to me, his face furious. "Get the fuck out, Cassidy," he screamed at me. "Get out, boy. I'm working." I fell backward in my haste to leave the shed and scrambled to my feet, racing through the woods to get back to the house, back to the safety of my mother. "Cass?" She greeted me as I ran, out of breath, confused and terrified, to where she stood in the backyard, hanging freshly washed laundry on a line. "Where are you coming from, Snow Baby?" "Where are you coming from?" "From something horrible," I thought, launching myself against her, burying my head in her skirt and wrapping my skinny arms around her slim waist. Even at 6, I knew something was terribly, terribly wrong with what I'd just seen. But instinctively, I knew not to mention the incident to her. Some secrets, especially the darkest ones, were too black to verbalize, too awful to share. "The woods," I said, smelling the sweet goodness of a denim skirt, which was warmed by the summer sunshine. "You know your daddy is leaving tonight, right, honey? Won't be back for about a month, don't you know?" She sighed. "Stay close, Cass. Don't go wandering off again. We'll have supper together. He'll want to say goodbye." My father was a long-haul truck driver. His normal route, he'd once shown me on a map, was from where we lived in northern Maine down the eastern seaboard to Florida and back again. Up to 12,000 miles a month on I-95, on 3 back-to-back trips, in a rig he owned himself. Which meant that we didn't see him very often. He was home for 2 or 3 days a month between drives. The rest of the time, Mama and I lived alone in our farmhouse on the outskirts of Crystal Lake, and spent our summers with my gramp, who had a cabin in the North Woods in the shadow of Katahdin. As a result, I didn't know my father very well, though my mother always prettied up when he was home, wearing skirts instead of jeans and her hair down instead of in a ponytail. Humming with happiness for those few days every month, she said my father liked his woman to look like a woman, and she was only too happy to oblige. For the 2 or 3 nights he was home, I wasn't allowed in Mama's room, but I heard all sorts of noises coming from under the door at night. Low-toned moans and groans, and the rhythmic squeaking of Mama's bed. It took me years to figure out what that meant. By my 8th birthday, I'd probably spent less than 100 days with my father. In my whole life. My 8th birthday. He happened to be home that day. It was the final day of 3 before he was supposed to hit the road again. It was also the day the Maine State Police knocked on our door to arrest him.
Chapter 3. Bryn.
Bryn! Over here!
I look up to see Jem's twin, Hope, waving at me from baggage claim as I descend the escalator at the Bangor airport. She has the same cheekbones as Jem, the same aqua eyes, the same unruly golden blonde hair that tumbles over her shoulders in sun-kissed waves. Her easy smile, so much like her brother's, makes my heart clutch. I hope that coming here isn't a giant mistake that will set me back in my progress toward normalcy. Then again, I reason, I'm living like a hermit with only my cat for company. There isn't much space in which to backslide.
Yeah,
she says with a smile. Heya. Hope, I say as I step from the escalator and into her arms.
It's so good to see you.
As she hugs me, tears spring to my eyes. Useless. When she leans back, her smile has faded.
Your skin and bones, Bryn.
I shrug. It's the dead fiancé diet. She cringes, jerking away from me, a shocked gasp escaping from her lips.
Fuck.
I'm sorry, I say, shaking my head frantically.
I'm so sorry, Hope. I don't know why I said that. Fuck, I'm sorry. I'm not fit to be around people. God, Hope, I am so, so sorry.
It's okay, she murmurs, though my thoughtless words have erased her smile completely. She takes a deep breath.
Any checked bags to pick up?
No.
Then, let's head to the car, huh?
I want to say something to make it all better as we walk in silence toward the parking garage, but nothing can take back my thoughtless words. And besides, I don't really want to whitewash the way I feel, not with Hope. Jem's gone. I know this. I know he's never coming back, but sometimes my sadness and my anger still feel hard as ice. That's how I saw them for a long time, in fact. Sadness and anger. An infinitely wide, infinitely thick casing of frost around my heart. Many days I didn't know how my heart kept beating, and there were days, I'm ashamed to admit now, I just wished it would stop. But it kept throbbing with life, like it knew that someday the ice would melt. I both dread and welcome the idea of that day. Loving someone new will hold such immeasurable risk for me. How could I bear losing someone all over again? But living like this for the rest of my life? In a constant state of grief? It's the only thought more unbearable than moving on. Because this isn't living. This is barely existing. And since I found Jem's phone again, I've started to wonder if maybe I'm ready to start living again.
I'm over here,
says Hope, pointing to a black SUV. She pops the trunk, and I lift my rolling bag into the back. Hope, I say, placing my hand on her arm after closing the hatch. I'm truly sorry.
I know,
she says, giving me a half-smile, half-grimace. While searching my eyes, she covers my hand with hers.
I haven't seen you since he was alive. You look a lot different, Bryn. You sound different, too.
The words sting, but she's right. That's the thing about losing someone you loved as much as I loved Jem. I can never be the person I was before. Never. I'm still trying to figure out who exactly I've become. I take a deep breath.
I'm hoping this trip will help.
Hope's eyes brighten a touch.
He would have loved it, you know. Climbing Katahdin with you. Sharing it with you.
I know, I whisper, gulping over the lump in my throat.
Come on,
she says, her hand slipping from my arm.
Let's get you back to my place, and we can talk about the best way to get you to the top.
For most of the plane ride to Maine, I read about Mount Katahdin in a tour book of New England I'd purchased in San Francisco. Katahdin, named by Native Americans, means the greatest mountain, and for Jem, nothing could have been closer to the truth. He'd climbed it the first time when he was 10, and if I asked Hope, she'd have no idea how many times he'd climbed it after that because he'd practically lived there. During high school summers, he made money as a guide, leading hikes up and down the granite face almost every weekend, and on weekdays for church groups and summer camps. Hope buckles her seatbelt, and I do the same, turning to her.
What do you think about me trying the knife edge?
She had shifted into reverse, but as she jerks her head to face me with a shocked expression, she pushes the gear shift back into park.
I'd ask you if you have a death wish.
Jem's favorite way to summit the mountain was on a trail called the Knife Edge. And yes, parts of the trail were only 3 feet wide with a steep drop-off on either side. And yes, the trail had claimed 23 lives over the past 5 decades. But I am here, and I am desperate to walk as closely in Jem's footsteps as possible.
Have you done it?
She nods, her face stony.
Yes?
Then why can't I? Hope turns away from me and backs out of the parking space.
Because, like my brother, I've been climbing Katahdin since I was 10.
I did some challenging climbs with Jem, I say. He took me to Yosemite every other weekend. I climbed Glacier Point.
Via the 4 Mile Trail.
Yeah?
Right. That's a strenuous trail to a peak under 1,000 meters high.
And?
What comes after strenuous on a trail rating?
Very strenuous?
Uh-huh. Well, then what?
I hum, trying to remember. Very, very strenuous? Hope rolls her eyes, then pays the garage attendant and drives into the night.
Do you know what the knife edge is rated?
No, but I feel like I'm about to get an earful.
That shit crazy, says Hope, stopping at a red light and turning to look at me with irritation and worry. That's what it's rated. It's only recommended for expert climbers.
She takes a deep breath, pressing on the gas as the light changes.
Bryn, should I be worried about you?
No. Leaning my elbow on the windowsill, I blink back the sting of tears.
I just wanna...
I know, says Hope, sighing as she turns onto the highway.
You wanna feel close to him, but you've gotta be smart if you're going to walk the greatest one. As opposed to Glacier Point, Baxter Peak is at 1,600 meters. An additional 50% climb, Bryn. You're going to be tired by the time you get to the top. Weary like you won't believe, and definitely not strong enough to take on the knife edge. No offense. Anyway, Jem would come back from the dead and kill me if I encouraged you to do it. It's one of the most dangerous trails in New England, in the world.
Okay, I say, reaching up to swipe at my eyes. No knife edge.
Phew. Thought you might fight me on it.
Nah, I get it. I nod my head, but my disappointment over the change in my hiking plans makes me change the subject. How are your parents? They've aged a lot, you know, after it happened, she shares with a heavy sigh. But they're salty New Englanders. They'll probably outlive us all. She glances over at me. Will you have time to see them while you're out here? I know I won't. Besides, I wouldn't know what to say to them, but Hope glances at me, so I try to give her the answer she wants. Maybe on Tuesday, on my way back to the airport? I'll definitely try, I say. How are you? Still loving your job? Hope is the youngest biology professor at the University of Maine. She nods, her face relaxing. Totally. Any good stories? She grins. Well, I met someone. I smile with her, surprising myself because I feel a rare wave of genuine happiness to hear her news. Shock me and tell me he's one of your students. Chuckling softly, she shakes her head, blonde waves undulating. Sorry to disappoint you. He's a professor of environmental studies at BU. Came up to RNO to teach a class, and luckily, I sat in. Love at first sight, I tease. It was the way he talked about land preservation, she says, sighing dramatically before winking at me. A biologist and a preservationist? You sound perfect for each other. I hope so, she admits, her voice wishful. Hey, I say, pieces of information clicking into place. Didn't you say you're going to Boston tomorrow? Yep. And how long have you two been together? 10 months, give or take. Do you think he's going to... Don't say it, it's bad luck. Propose? I whisper over her warning. Oh, see what you did? Man, I hope you didn't jinx it. Sorry, I say, cocking my head to the side. But now that it's out there, do you? Like I said, I hope so. For just a moment, my brain flashes back to Jem on one knee, his aqua blue eyes outshining the sky behind him as he opened a tiny white velvet box in his palm. Bryn, will you marry me? I clench my eyes shut for just a moment and take a deep breath, then open them again as I exhale, bracing for the wave of panic that always accompanies an especially poignant memory. Maybe it's being away from the place where I'd lost him, or being with his sister who'd loved him as deeply as I had, or this plan to climb Katahdin and bid him farewell. But instead of panic, a wave of peace washes over me and the tears recede. With a sigh of relief, I roll down my window and breathe in the Maine air, grateful that memories of my own proposal warm me instead of destroy me. I hope so too, I say, looking over at Jem's twin sister and praying that her future holds all the happiness stolen from her brother. I really, really do.
Chapter 4 Cassidy, 9 years old. The elementary school secretary, Mrs. Hughes, peeks at me over the counter with cold eyes, and I slink down farther on my chair, staring at my beat-up sneakers, which are covered in drying puke. After lunch, two kids trap me in the bathroom, the smaller of the two standing in front of the door, while the bigger one asked me if I was a raping, murdering fuck like my father. When I didn't answer, he pushed me so hard that I stumbled backward into the sink, crying out as the thin flesh covering my hip met the smooth, hard, unforgiving porcelain. "One eye blue and one eye green," he sneered, spittle collecting in the corner of his mouth as he advanced on me. "It's weird as fuck. You're a goddamned freak, killer." He pushed me again, and I whimpered softly. "You gonna cry?" he asked. I wanted to cry. Heck, I wanted to cry just about every day of my life, but instead I sucked in my cheeks and clamped my teeth around the warm, wet flesh, willing the pain of the bite to overwhelm my tears as I stared down at the tiled floor. "You don't belong in this town no more," he said. "You and your mama give everyone the creeps. You gotta move on."
"JJ, we gotta go. Someone's gonna come."
"Shut up, Kenny."
JJ turned back to me, smacking my cheek twice, hard, forcing me to look up.
"You look at me when I'm talking to you, boy."
His eyes were brown and mean when I met them.
"You heard me? No one wants you here, killer."
I gulped down the rising bile in my throat.
"No one wants your tainted blood here.
JJ,
no one wants the reminder of who your daddy was and what he'd done."
I tried to swallow again, but it felt like the muscles of my throat had frozen and I couldn't force them to work.
"No one wants..."
A sharp, unavoidable heaving sensation lifted the contents of my stomach, and I opened my mouth just in time for my regurgitated lunch to splash all over JJ's Patriot sweatshirt, blue jeans, and Nikes.
"Fuck!"
he screamed, jolting back.
"What the fuck?"
Tears streamed from my eyes, more a result of the puke than a reaction to the meanness. Vomit dripped from my lips and chin, onto my red t-shirt, onto my scarred Walmart sneakers.
"Screw this!"
yelled Kenny, opening the bathroom door and disappearing into the hallway.
"You're gonna pay for this, you little shit!"
bellowed JJ, turning around to follow Kenny. My shirt and shoes were covered in throw up, and without a change of clothes, I couldn't go back to class. So I headed to the nurse's office instead. She took one look at me and gasped without sympathy, giving me a pair of sweatpants and an old t-shirt from the lost and found. While I was getting dressed, I heard her tell the school secretary to call my mother. Mama arrived 40 minutes later, her eyes worried as she looked into mine. I mumbled something about being sorry, but she told me to stay put as she hurried into the principal's office. Sitting on a chair outside his half-open door, I can hear just about everything he's saying to her.
"This school simply isn't a good fit for Cassidy, Miss Potter. I'm sure you can appreciate how uneasy the other children are around your son."
"But why?"
she says softly, her voice emotional.
"Cass is a good boy. Kind."
Mr. Ruggins clears his throat.
"We've never had a problem with Cassidy per se, and to be clear, I can't make you pull him from school, ma'am. But I can tell you that episodes like today will not be isolated. I imagine it'll just get worse for your son as time goes on."
"I don't understand. He wouldn't hurt a fly,"
she says.
"He's gentle and..."
"No one here is disputing that, Miss Potter. But I think it would be better for Cassidy and for you, ma'am, to think about homeschooling him."
"Homeschooling? But I'm not a teacher. I don't know how to teach him."
I imagine Mr. Ruggins leaning forward as his chair squeaks.
"Don't need to be. You can buy a book from the Walmart over in Lincoln that'll tell you how to teach him everything he needs to know. We can even order it for you if that would help. Or I can ask Mrs. Hughes to make a recommendation for you."
"But what about friends? He'll be lonely with no one but me for company."
"Miss Potter," says Mr. Ruggins gently, "Cassidy doesn't have any friends, ma'am."
"Of course he does,"
she says.
"Joey Gilligan, Sam White, Marcus."
"No, ma'am," says Mr. Ruggins firmly. "He doesn't have any friends anymore. Cassidy sits alone at lunch, alone on a bench at recess. He walks through the halls alone. No one speaks to him unless it's to give him a hard time. He minds his business, yes, ma'am, but trouble still finds him."
My mother sobs, and it tears at my heart a little because I'd been keeping it a secret, how the other kids have been treating me since my father's arrest and conviction. I didn't want her to worry about something else. Now she knows, and I can tell it's hurt her. I clench my fists, and even though my cheeks are still raw and bleeding from chewing on them in the bathroom, I bite down anyway.
"Mr. Ruggins, Cassidy didn't do anything wrong,"
says my mother, her voice breaking a little.
"But his daddy sure did," says Mr. Ruggins,
His chair squeaks again, and this time I imagine him leaning away from my mother. Ask the families of those poor girls. He did wrong, all right.
Paul is... well, he is a very sick man. We didn't... that is, we had no idea what was going on. He was away all the time, and...
She pauses before speaking again.
But Cassidy's just a child. He's only 9 years old. He's not his father.
Cassidy is his son, ma'am. His son. I am the son of the man one reporter called the bloodiest serial killer the state of Maine has ever known. My mother tried to protect me from the truth, but there was no hiding it during the trial and sentencing. It was on the TV and in the newspapers at the grocery store. It was everywhere. My father, Paul Isaac Porter, raped and murdered at least a dozen girls along the I-95 corridor between 1990 and 1998. It's a fact. And now it follows me wherever I go. Rapist's son. Murderer's son. Freak. Killer. Since his arrest, and especially since his conviction, I've been called every ugly thing you can think of. People cross the street when they see me and Mama coming. They egg our house and throw rocks through our windows. They move out of our pew at church when we sit down. The waitresses at the town diner pretend they don't see us, even when Mama asks if we can place our order. Even good people, like my teachers, like the pastor and his wife, like Mr. Ruggins, can barely look us in the eye. Mama cries all the time. She calls herself stupid and naive and says that she should have known. She doesn't sleep much. She jumps at the slightest sound. And lately, when she doesn't think I notice, she stares at me hard, like she's puzzling through something. If I catch her, she looks away quickly, like I would if I was caught doing something wrong. Cassidy is his son, ma'am. But I'm not him. I'm me. A separate person. There's a long and painful silence as I wait for my mother to say something, anything else, to try to explain that my father and I are individual people. I didn't rape anyone. I didn't murder anyone. I didn't hurt anyone. Not ever. But she doesn't say anything, and her silence is chilling.
You take him on home today, ma'am, says Mr. Ruggins after a long and awkward silence. And you think on what I said. Okay, now? I'm certain it would be best for everyone.
When Mama emerges from Mr. Ruggins' office a second later, her face is white and her eyes are red and weepy, shell-shocked and defeated.
Mama?
I murmur, feeling worried as I take a hand and look up into her bloodshot blue eyes. She looks down at me and lifts her chin.
We're leaving.
I walk beside her out of the office, down the hallway, and out the double doors to the parking lot. I'm silent as I get into the back seat and buckle my belt. Silent as my mother starts the car, and silent as she cries quietly all the way home.
Chapter 5. Bryn. When we get to her place, Hope opens a bottle of good Merlot and barbecues steaks for us, telling me climbing stories about her and Jem while the steaks sizzle and the stars come out. She tells me about how Jem saved the life of a little girl who'd gotten separated from her family during a camping trip. None of the rangers could find her, but Jem, who knew every nook and cranny of Katahdin, managed to find her near one of the waterfalls on the hunt trail. He was only 15, but that's when I knew that climbing mountains wasn't just a hobby for him, says Hope, sipping her wine while fireflies light up her backyard like a chain of blinking Christmas lights. It was the look on his face when he walked into the parking lot where they'd set up a triage center. He was covered in trail dust. She looked even worse, but he... well, I knew we'd never get him out of the woods after that. He never told me that story. I take a sip of my wine. God, I miss him. She sighs from where she stands beside the grill, putting a hand on her hip. Promise you won't get mad if I say something? My eyes widen. Are you going to say something mean? Not mean, really. Just frank. I gulp. Okay. I didn't really get you to. Get us. Don't get me wrong. You made him happy, and I'm 100% certain that he loved you. I take another sip of my wine, looking up at her from where I sit on a picnic bench near the grill, waiting for her to continue. But I think I always thought he'd end up with someone who loved the outdoors. You know, hiking, climbing, camping, all of it, as much as he did. I liked it, I mumble. No, says Hope. And though I've never seen her teach, I have a sudden taste of her in professor mode. You tolerated it, because it was part of his job and because you loved him, and maybe even... She pauses for a moment, nailing me with her eyes. Because you thought you could change him. You're assuming a lot. Am I? Her voice trails off, and I suspect we are getting to the part that has the potential to get me mad. I worried about it lasting, you and Jem. I worried that you'd eventually make him choose. Her words suck the air from my lungs, and my vision blurs. Oh. Bryn, she starts gently, shutting the lid of the grill and coming to sit next to me. I don't mean to hurt you. I swear I don't. But I just wonder if, over time, if maybe you would have gone to the woods less. You didn't grow up hiking and climbing. You couldn't tell me, here and now, with any conviction that you loved it. But he did. It wasn't even selfishness. It was instinct. It was need. It was in his blood. And there was no way you were ever going to get him out of the woods. I wasn't trying to get him out of the woods. I loved him just the way he was. I know you did, she says, wincing as she tilts her head to the side. But would you have wanted to hike and camp for every vacation? Would you have wanted to raise your kids in the woods every weekend? She pauses, shaking her head. You lived in the city, in the middle of San Francisco, Bryn. Going hiking was an excursion for you, a day trip. For Jem, it was a way of life. His job was to write about hiking and climbing, and I suspect that's the part of him you tolerated and tried to accept by joining him from time to time. But you must know, even when he was with you, he was subjugating a part of his nature by living in the city. He longed to be in the wild constantly, all the time, every weekend, every moment. He told you that, he was selling himself out? I knew him better than anyone, she says quietly. I was watching it. I was worried for him and for you, for both of you. Hope's eyes are sad as she looks back at me with a level gaze, and it pinches my heart. Part of the reason her words hurt so much is because they address a truth I ignored, that I never fully admitted to myself. That over time, I may have gone to the woods with Jem less and less because I didn't love it, and Jem wouldn't have been able to stay away because he did. And maybe I would have resented his precious woods for stealing him away. I might have even started to resent him, too. You shared your worries with Jem? I ask, rephrasing my previous question. I want to know if they discussed this behind my back. She lifts her chin and nods. He was my twin. What did he say? I ask, my voice a rasp. That he could love you both, that you'd figure it out together. We would have, I say, looking into her eyes, feeling confused, angry. She stands up, crosses the patio, and lifts the lid of the grill to flip the steaks. My righteous indignation mounts as I finish my wine. How dare she question the strength of our love? How dare she doubt a relationship that never even had a chance? Why did you tell me this? I ask. What's the point? She turns around, her expression sympathetic but not sorry. Because you've been grieving for 2 years. So what? I ask with a bite. So it's easy to idealize someone who's dead, to make your life a shrine to them. Do you think it was easy to lose my fiancé? I ask, leaping to my feet. To lose the love of my life? No, she answers softly. I think it was excruciating. Then, Jem wasn't a god, she whispers, tears brightening her own eyes.